Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Getting ready for an out-of-town vacation, we'll talk about some St. Louis vacation traditions a little later, but first, we'll be talking about a different kind of journey to the afterlife. Most of us are familiar with the manner in which Egyptians buried their pharaohs and other notables. All cultures have their burial rituals, but the Egyptians were perhaps more spectacular than most. The St. Louis Science Center is currently running an exhibit titled Lost Egypt, Ancient Secrets, Modern Science. One of the featured speakers at the exhibit was Michelle Loyett of Webster University. She's an adjunct professor on Near Eastern and Egyptian archaeology. Her topic at the Science Center, the tradition of mummification in Egypt. Michelle joins us in studio. So nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
This is a fascinating subject area. Is it fair to say that the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, were perhaps the most spectacular when it comes to burying their dead notables?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They built amazing monuments to their dead in the forms of the pyramids of Egypt. And if you look at the Egyptian beliefs regarding the afterlife, the Egyptians believed that you lived in the tomb forever. So they spent significantly more time and expense in building their tombs than they did in building their houses.
And of course, the outside is spectacular enough, but what was inside was pretty good too.
Well, one of the things you can consider, for example, we're all very familiar with the riches that went into the tomb of King Tutankhamun, discovered by Howard Carter in the 1920s. And there were amazing amounts of gold and offerings and wealth that was placed in that tomb. But one of the really interesting things about that is if you consider that in perspective of who exactly King Tut was. And King Tut was a minor king from a disgraced dynasty. And if you see the amount of wealth that went into the tomb for him, if you can imagine then for a king such as Ramses or Seti or Amenhotep III, who expanded the borders of Egypt all the way to the Euphrates River, their tombs must have been doubly spectacular.
Why don't we know?
Well, for one thing, tomb robbing was significant. When you consider the number of people that were involved in the building of tombs, huge crews of workmen, artisans, goldsmiths, metalsmiths, craftsmen, scribes, lots of people were aware of what went into those tombs. And as a result, tomb robbing was rife in ancient Egypt, so much so that there were even special punishments for people who were caught in tomb robbing. But on the other hand, with so much wealth in the tombs, it's something that was almost unavoidable. And for that reason, we see the ancient Egyptians moving from these huge monuments to the dead, such as the pyramids, to underground rock-cut tombs by the New Kingdom in an effort to hide those materials.
I somehow, and I'm certainly not a student or an expert on this era, but I thought that the tomb looting came much later. You're suggesting that it happened pretty much at about the same time.
There is evidence that it did happen at the same time. For example, one of the best resources that we have in regards to mummification is what we call the Deir el-Medina mummy cache. And that consists of a number of New Kingdom pharaohs, 17th and 18th dynasty, that the priests who oversaw the Valley of the Kings actually during later dynasties collected those mummies, made some repairs to them, even in some cases where the mummies had been broken apart by thieves looking for jewelry and amulets, and then hid them in a few small out-of-the-way tombs. And that actually happened in ancient time. That was rediscovered in the 19th century when some of the artifacts that were credited to those kings' dynasties began to appear on the black market, and ultimately it was discovered where that cache was. But it's actually become one of our best sources of information about mummification because they did save and protect so many mummies.
Why mummification?
Well, the Egyptians believed that that your soul had a number of parts. For example, the Ba, often depicted in hieroglyphics and artwork as a human-headed bird, your Ba could leave your body and travel outside your body. They thought that when you dreamt, that was your Ba traveling. But the Ba always had to return to the body. Same thing with the Ka. The Ka is the part of the spirit that actually lives in the tomb and partakes of the offerings left behind. And also your Ankh is the part of your spirit that went into the heavens with the gods. But those other parts of your spirit needed the body to return to, otherwise they would wander. And for that reason, we see not only mummification happening so that your spirit can continue to survive in that body and in that tomb, but we also see forms of tomb insurance, like Ka statues. So if your mummy is destroyed, your Ka can live in that Ka statue. And if that's destroyed, the Egyptians believed that your Ka could live in an inscription of your name. So for that reason, we often see when a pharaoh is disgraced that subsequent pharaohs may chisel their name off of their monuments as a way of taking away that magic that's in the name.
How did they mummify? What was the process?
Well, the process was essentially dehydration. They use natron salts, which are a type of sodium salt that comes from Wadi Natrun in Egypt. And if you can imagine sticking your body in about a ton of those little silica packets that come in your shoes, then essentially it draws out all the moisture from the body. They also eviscerate the body, remove the internal organs, and they're preserved separately and placed in jars that we call canopic jars. So by removing those organs, you get rid of the bacteria, for example, that's in the gut, and then placing it in that drying salt, it dries the mummy significantly. Once the drying is complete, they would then anoint the mummy with oil and beeswax and then begin wrapping it in linen. And as they wrap it in linen, they do things to preserve the image of the individual. So they might stuff their cheeks with something to make them look more lifelike. We've found mummies, for example, that have tiny little onions inserted behind the eyelids to make it look like their eyes are closed rather than sunken. And then once they're wrapped, they're placed in their sarcophagus.
We're getting fairly close to lunchtime. maybe we ought to leave this part for another discussion on it. At another time. Did the kings themselves have any say in the planning of how they were going to be entombed?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you consider, for example, the Great Pyramid, the only way that such a pyramid could be built was if the king brought his power to bear to force people to work for him. If you think about Egypt, there's actually not a lot of evidence, for example, for slave labor. I know that a lot of times popular books say that the pyramids were built by slaves. But if you consider that with the annual flooding of the Nile, a huge portion of the populace, the farming peasantry, their fields were underwater for 3 months of the year. So the Egyptian kings used something called corvée labor, which was paying your taxes in the form of labor. So all of those people that aren't farming because their fields are covered by water can work on building the pyramids. And it takes a huge amount of power to bring that many people to work for you.
Well, what I also seen somewhere that the workers, those who helped build the pyramids, were also at a certain level entitled to pyramids themselves.
Yes. In fact, if you look at the workmen's village that is being excavated on the Giza Plateau, the workmen themselves, because they were the artisans who were building the tombs, who were creating the treasures that went into the tombs, they often made imitations of them. So you do see some small pyramid tombs or tombs that have artifacts very similar to those that went into the king's tombs, maybe gold plate instead of solid gold. But all the same, they imitated what they were doing for the kings.
Well, how about the other Egyptians, those who are not part of the aristocracy or the pyramid builders? How were they dealt with?
Well, very often they were simply buried in pit tombs in the ground. But one of the interesting things about that is if you go back to the pre-dynastic period when everyone was buried in pit tombs in the sand, natural mummification occurs in that environment when the body is in direct contact with the hot sands of the desert. It leaches away the moisture from the individual's body and created natural mummification that in the earlier periods of artificial mummification, the Egyptians weren't even able to preserve the bodies as well as nature had done in the pre-dynastic. But even with those individuals who are placed in simple pit tombs, you do still find significant offerings being placed with them, the things that they used in life, so that it'll be with them in death.
I was just about to ask that question because I had read that things like combs that they might need in the afterlife would be placed amongst the riches if they had the riches.
Absolutely. If you look at the materials that are provided for the dead in either, you know, a very small pit tomb all the way up to the tomb of the pharaoh, that essentially all those things that individual enjoyed in life, their cosmetic palette, their combs, their wigs, their clothing, their shoes, furniture, offerings of food, all of that would go into the tomb, even things like games and dolls. And if, for example, someone had a child who had died, they might even place the mummy of the child in the tomb as well.
What about the riches? I mean, the gold and the jewels, was that kind of buy your way in, or was it to support you wherever you wound up?
In many ways, it's simply an outward representation of your status in life. So your status in death is the same as your status in life. So with those individuals who are very wealthy, or with the kings and queens, an incredible amount of riches go into the tomb because that represents their status in life. You don't want to lose status in death. But even among people who were less wealthy, you might find imitations of those. Oh, wow. So rather than precious stones, faience, which is a kind of low-fired glass that imitates precious stones.
And when did all of this stop?
Well, it actually did not stop until the very, very late periods. Even into the Hellenistic and Roman period, we see mummification continued. It becomes sort of mixed together with Roman and Greek tradition. So, for example, in the catacombs under Alexandria, you'll find tomb paintings of, for example, Anubis, the god of the dead, dressed as a centurion. So it becomes incorporated into those later periods. And the Ptolemies, General Ptolemy, who had been placed in Egypt by Alexander the Great, that family became completely enmeshed in Egyptian tradition to the extent that they even practiced the brother-sister marriage that had been tradition among Egyptian kings.
You're listening to Michelle Loyette of Webster University. We're talking about the way the ancient Egyptians buried their dead, and it's all in conjunction with a major exhibit at the St. Louis Science Center. I'll have more information on that in just a couple of moments. If you'd like to get into the conversation, we've got another 10-15 minutes or so with Michelle, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. We'll be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. And before we continue our conversation with Michelle Loyette of Webster University, we are talking about the way Egyptians, ancient Egyptians, buried their dead. I want to advise our listening audience that we will be moving to a new time slot on Monday. We'll be moving from the 11 to 12 hour to noon to 1 o'clock. We think this will be a much more convenient time for listeners. We're looking forward to it and hope you are too. So make a note, if you would, that St. Louis on the Air moves to noon on Monday. That's where we'll remain for a good long time, I suspect. Join us then, noon on Monday for St. Louis on the Air. Okay, Michelle, back to a different era, long before radios and before changing time slots. What was the caste system? We talked about the workers who helped build the pyramids and that they had small pyramids themselves. And we've certainly talked about the rulers, the pharaohs. What about the nobility down the line? What happened to them?
Well, the nobility, actually one of the best resources that we have about the nobility in Egypt is at the necropolis of Saqqara. You might be familiar with the step pyramid of King Djoser. That was one of the first pyramids built. Very often what's left out of many of the presentations of the Saqqara necropolis is that completely surrounding that pyramid are smaller tombs for the nobility. They call them mastabas because they're bench-shaped, and that's the Arabic word for bench. So these long, low, rectangular buildings. And the nobles, in many ways, imitated what it was that the kings were doing. So they had extensive inscriptions. They had mummification. They had sarcophagi. They had places where family could leave offerings. The tombs themselves were filled with resources for them in death. And the nobility, the mastaba as a type of tomb, persisted throughout extensive periods in Egypt until we begin to see the nobility also being buried in rock-cut tombs, like we see the king in the New Kingdom.
What typically were the kinds of things that were noted on the inscriptions?
Well, the Egyptians, they pretty much wrote down everything. So in the inscriptions, there may be magical spells to protect the tomb and protect the mummy. There may also be hymns and praises to the gods that would assist the individual in the afterlife. But then we also see extensive carvings and inscriptions that are specifically designed to provide for that individual in the afterlife. As we talked before, they believed that they would live in that tomb forever. So one of the best resources that we have about daily life in ancient Egypt are the incredible number of carvings and reliefs that are placed in these tombs that show people harvesting wheat, fishing, hunting, herding animals that were specifically designed to provide for that individual in the afterlife.
Weren't there sacrifices also made?
There is not a significant indication of sacrifice in ancient Egypt. One of the things that the Egyptians did to get around that, we see in Mesopotamia, there are cases where servants are sacrificed and placed in the tombs. For example, at the Ur III Cemetery, in the tomb of Queen Puabi, there are multiple people who were placed in the tomb with her. But in Egypt, they got around that by using something that we call shabtis, which are, they look like little dolls that are placed in the tomb. And in some tombs, you'll see crate after crate of shabtis. And these shabtis are specifically designed to serve the individual in their afterlife. And it's even carved on the shabti, "I am here to serve." And these were their servants in the afterlife.
Where do we want to go from here in terms of the construction of these pyramids? How long did they actually take?
Well, they took in some cases as much as a decade to get those pyramids constructed. It was essentially a labor of brute strength to move all the stones for the pyramids. And you can see through the development of pyramid building, for example, with the step pyramid, the construction mechanism largely imitated what they did with mud brick in building their houses. So if you look at the stones that are utilized in building the step pyramids, they're the size and shape of mud bricks. They're simply stone instead of mud brick. But by the time we reach the pyramids of Giza, the great pyramids, the culmination of pyramid building, the stones are massive. And the only way that these can be moved is essentially through teams of men dragging them to where they need to be.
Over how long a period was this going on? I mean, obviously it had a starting point and an ending point. How many generations, if you will?
Well, it the pyramid building actually went on for quite a long time. During the Old Kingdom, when pyramid building began, you can see between King Djoser and the building of the Great Pyramids at Giza, it's only a few hundred years. And those are really kind of the golden age of pyramid building. At the end of the Old Kingdom, what happened was Egypt kind of descended into a period of anarchy. There was no centralized rule. And when the country was reunited under a single leader again, that's when we see the beginning of the Middle Kingdom. The Middle Kingdom very much saw the Old Kingdom as kind of an ideal that should be lived up to. So we see a second period of significant pyramid building in the Middle Kingdom because it was specifically designed to imitate the Old Kingdom. The interesting thing about the Middle Kingdom, though, is that we don't have a whole lot of those pyramids preserved because it was an imitation. Very often they were mud brick pyramids that had a stone skin, and those stones were often robbed later for other construction. So there are all these pyramids in Egypt that you wouldn't know they were pyramids because they look like a mound of dirt without their stone casing. But they still at one time were pyramids designed to recreate the images from the Old Kingdom.
And how many pyramids overall are there?
Over the entire country of Egypt, we have hundreds of pyramids, but so many of them are those Middle Kingdom imitations. Also, if you look at the pyramids at Giza, you have the great pyramids for the king, but you also have minor pyramids for the queens. So you'll see a little row of three pyramids next to the Great Pyramid, and that's actually for the wives of the king. And but they're very small.
Egypt was during the period that we've been talking about here, of course, very, very influential in the then known world. Did this practice, the burial practice, influence any other cultures?
We do see pyramids in other cultures. In fact, in the Sudan, which would be just to the south of Egypt, we see small pyramids there. We don't want to make the mistake, however, in thinking that the pyramids of Egypt influenced pyramid building in Mesoamerica, for example. A lot of us have visited Mayan pyramids. But when you think about it, the pyramid is actually the simplest large-scale structure to make. So if you imagine, for example, sand dropping through an hourglass, that sand actually creates a pyramid because it's stable. So it's not unusual that we would see pyramids in multiple contexts.
It has been suggested somewhere that the alignment of pyramids may have been significant, and you're nodding that it was.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things that we see, if you look at the pyramids of Giza, the pyramids themselves are aligned with the cardinal directions, north, south, east, west. They're aligned with the cardinal directions. But they are not placed – they appear, when you look at them from the ground, they appear to be in a straight line. But if you look at them from the air, it's not quite a straight line. One is slightly offset from the other two. And it imitates the offset of the three stars that create Orion's belt. Orion to Egyptians wasn't Orion, it was Osiris. And Osiris was the god of the underworld and believed to be the first mummy. So to the Egyptians, they followed that patterning that they saw in the skies that they saw representing Osiris in the ground and creating their pyramids.
What would you say are the great myths about this culture and what we're talking about today?
Well, I think that certainly one of the great myths that we see is that very often people want to assume that some outside force is what is responsible for the creation of the pyramids. And during the very early periods of archaeology, even professional archaeologists believed that some outside culture entered Egypt and created these pyramids and created the Egyptian culture. But it is absolutely an in situ development of a very complex, very amazing state-level society.
What do we have yet to learn about all of this? There must be great mysteries still out there.
Everything. you could spend the next 100 years just excavating the Egyptian Museum. If you've ever been to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, it's such an incredibly different experience from going to a museum here in the United States. The Egyptian Museum itself is just packed to the gills with artifacts, and that doesn't even include the things that are in storage. Things that were excavated as far back as the 19th century are still in storage, and they're. Even if no excavation took place in the next 10 years in Egypt, you could still learn an incredible amount just from examining those things that had never been looked at before.
And with justification, they're very, very protective of all of these things. And we do read from time to time that some of these artifacts will show up in other parts of the world, and Egypt works very, very hard to get them back.
Absolutely. Egypt has one of the strongest set of antiquities laws among any of the countries that American archaeologists typically work in. They have a very, very strong and very well-organized Department of Antiquities that oversees all permitting of excavation. And any materials excavated cannot be removed from Egypt. In fact, they're trying now to have materials repatriated that had been removed in earlier periods. For example, the very famous bust of Nefertiti, which is in the Berlin Museum, has been a point of contention in that it was originally, during the 19th century, removed from Egypt by a diplomat, and they now would like that back.
Before we say goodbye, tell our listeners what they can expect to find at the Science Center.
The Science Center is a really fantastic experience and is well presented for both, people who know quite a bit about Egypt, as well as folks that are just now getting into it. And even for kids, they have some great little activities for kids that include a camel that they can climb on. They have excavation units that the kids can dig in, but they also have some really great video presentations. There are mummies that you can look at CAT scans of the mummies and manipulate the CAT scans so that you can see what's underneath the wrappings. Overall, a fantastic exhibit that's good for any age.
Yeah, well, it sounds fascinating, and it's a fascinating subject. And I thank you, Michelle Loyette, for being with us and sharing your expertise with me and with our listeners. Certainly appreciate it. That exhibit at the Science Center, it's called Lost Egypt, Ancient Secrets, Modern Science. It's open now through September 2nd, and we have more information on our website, stlpublicradio.org. Again, Michelle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And when we come back, we'll discuss some history of St. Louis vacation destinations. Where do you go to beat the heat? This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.